ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Oh, but we'll repeat this one. Purusha prakritisto hi bhunkte prakriti jan gunan karanam guna sangosya sara sadyoni janmasu prak purusha. Translation: the living entity in material nature thus follows the ways of life, enjoying the three modes of nature. This is due to his association with that material nature. Thus, he meets with good and evil among various species. Text number 23. Yet in this body, there is another, a transcendental enjoyer, who is the Lord, the supreme proprietor, who exists as the overseer and permitter, and who is known as the Supersoul. Purport. It is stated here that the Supersoul, who is always with the individual soul, is the representation of the Supreme Lord. He is not an ordinary living entity. Because the monist philosophers take the knower of the body to be one, they think that there is no difference between the Supersoul and the individual soul. To clarify this, the Lord says that he is represented as the Paramatma in every body. He is different from the individual soul. He is para, transcendental. The individual soul enjoys the activities of a particular field, but the Supersoul is present not as finite enjoyer, nor as one taking part in bodily activities, but as the witness, overseer, permitter, and supreme enjoyer. His name is Paramatma, not Atma. And he is transcendental. It is distinctly clear that the Atma and Paramatma are different. The Supersoul, the Paramatma, has legs and hands everywhere, but the individual soul does not. And because the Paramatma is the Supreme Lord, he is present within to sanction the individual soul's desiring material enjoyment. Without the sanction of the Supreme Soul, the individual soul cannot do anything. The individual is Bhukta, or the sustained, and the Lord is Bhukta, or the maintainer. There are innumerable living entities, and he is staying in them as a friend. The fact is that every individual living entity is eternally part and part of the Supreme Lord, and both of them are very intimately related as friends. But the living entity has the tendency to reject the sanction of the Supreme Lord and act independently in an attempt to dominate nature. And because he has this tendency, he is called the marginal energy of the Supreme Lord. The living entity can be situated either in the material energy or in the spiritual energy. As long as he is conditioned by the material energy, the Supreme Lord, as his friend, the Supersoul, stays with him just to get him to return to the spiritual energy. The Lord is always eager to take him back to the spiritual energy, but due to his minute independence, the individual entity is continually rejecting the association of spiritual light. This misuse of independence is the cause of his material strife in the conditioned nature. The Lord, therefore, is always giving instruction from within and from without. From without, he gives instructions as stated in the Bhagavad Gita, and from within, he tries to convince the living entity that his activities in the material field are not conducive to real happiness. Just give it up and turn your faith toward me. Then you will be happy, he says. Thus, the intelligent person who places his faith in the Paramatma, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead, begins to advance toward a blissful, eternal life of knowledge. Verse and translation again. Upadrashtanumanta cha bharta bhokta maheshvara paramatmeti chapyukto dehismin purusha paraha. Yet in this body there is another, a transcendental enjoyer, who is the Lord, the supreme proprietor, who exists as the overseer and permitter, and who is known as the Supersoul. Hare Krishna. So I'd like to thank everyone for assembling together tonight for Bhagavad Gita class. I'm very grateful that you've given me this opportunity to speak something from the sacred Bhagavad Gita. So 13th chapter, Arjuna at the beginning has asked three questions. He wants to know, more or less, three things. What is the enjoyer? What is the nature? And what is consciousness? And so Krishna has answered that the object of knowledge to be known, the knower of the field, is both the Atma and the Supersoul. And the topic of this verse is the Supersoul. So in spite of the fact this verse is about the Supersoul, what I wanted to talk to you about today is about one bird. Why a bird? Because I think there's a very special bird, and he lives in Australia. His name is the East Australian Mallee Fowl. And he sheds a lot of light on the existence of the Supersoul and is important in our lives. So what could a dumb animal possibly have to do with the Supersoul? But as I will explain, this single bird in and of itself provides sufficient evidence to any person with faith in God to refute Darwin's evolutionary theory. Just this one single example of the behavior behind this little tiny bird, no bigger than a chicken, but this bird, assuredly, you can use this example to defeat any evolutionist, anyone who claims that life just comes from matter, that there is no God, that there is no intelligence behind the creation. This bird is enough to outwit all the genius big brain sciences in the scientific community. And why is that? If we examine his behavior, single-handedly he proves that he must have been created, first of all, by a god, and secondly, that the only way this bird could engage in his activities is only if there was a Supersoul inside his heart, if God was actually directing his activities and his behavior. So this East Australian Mallee Fowl that I want to tell you about is a very unique type of bird, and that he's called an incubator bird. And so the difference between him and a chicken, for example, is that a chicken will lay an egg and will roost on the egg, will actually sit on it in order to regulate the temperature and to hatch a chicken. The chicken is actually present to generate its own body heat to allow the egg to fertilize sufficiently and hatch. However, on the other hand, our Australian friend, the hen does not actually roost on the egg, but uses an external source of heat. She creates an incubator, creates a nest. Like sometimes when you go to the hospital, you see that premature babies, they're put in a special enclosure, a little dome, where very carefully the temperature is guarded, is maintained, so that this premature baby, who's too small, can actually get sufficient warmth and attention in order to grow into a full-size baby. And so this incubator at the hospital, how much does one of these units cost? So many thousands of dollars. And how much intelligence and planning went into the design of this piece of machinery? It's a very recent invention. And yet we see that these, you know, medical engineers were not the first ones to think of this concept. This little pea-brained bird actually designed its own incubator in nature with no electricity, using only the materials that are available in the forest. So what intelligence did this bird have? How can it develop all this intelligence on its own? Clearly, it has a friend. And so, as I'm about to argue, the Supersoul is the one who's giving the intelligence to this bird how to create this. So the way it works is that a male and female Mallee Fowl, they will get together, and they actually remain loyal to each other throughout life. They'll only accept one partner. But when reproduction season comes around, that to plan it out, they start digging the nest. And so they'll dig 3 feet into the ground, 15 feet wide. They'll just start scratching at the ground with their paws and create a big hole. And within this hole, what do they fill inside? They go around and collect various leaves and twigs and combinations of sand and dirt, and they fill up this hole. And then, it's not enough to just have the leaves and twigs there. The male and female, they wait very patiently for the rains to start. Because when the rains come, then the leaves in the hole become moist. And when they become moist, they start to rot. They become too humid, and the rotting leaves will actually generate heat because of the energy that's released. So the intelligent thing about these birds is they actually don't wait for their reproductive, they don't come together until the rains have come. So they're actually so self-controlled. You see, human beings, how much sense control do we have? Do a husband and wife plan out their birth very carefully? In cultured countries and civilized cultures, they will. They'll discuss beforehand, oh, maybe we should have a child on this auspicious day. Let's not just have it as an accident. Because according to the Vedic science, if husband and wife plan out in advance, they find the auspicious nakshatra, titi, they find the proper day for conception, they can actually plan what type of child they want. A high-quality soul with good intelligence, they can actually plan whether they want a male if they come together on an even day or a female on an odd day. And so the Vedic culture gives this culture of this knowledge of how to create children at the auspicious moment by following the scriptures. But as John Lennon once famously pointed out, famous Beatle, he said that most of the children of our generation were born how? They're born over a bottle of whiskey on a Saturday night. No real forethought or planning went into it. And the result is you get unwanted progeny. And so human beings don't quite understand this science. They're willing to let their lusty desires overwhelm them. And often, I read some statistic, in the United States, over 50% of the childbirths in the country are complete accidents. That the parents never wanted them in the first place. And this is why the abortion rate is so astronomically high. Because no actual forethought goes into it. But we see with these birds in Australia, on the other hand, they have some intelligence and they know that in order to have a successful conception, we need to take it easy and slow down. We need to wait for that moment. So when the rains start coming, maybe it's very romantic too, I don't know, but they produce eggs, and what is it? About 30 in one hatch, in one clutch, it's called. 30 eggs, more or less. And so they place these eggs on top of the bed of leaves. And it's not just like that. At this point, the leaves are exposed, so the temperature will vary too much. And so therefore, what does the male do? He's very intelligent. He starts digging, and he throws sand on top of these eggs, and he piles up about 3 feet of sand, such that you have about a 5-foot mound in the middle of the forest. And this is the nest that the mallee fowl uses to roost its eggs inside of. And so at this point, it's an interesting male-female dynamic. I guess the birds were into, you know, gender equality before we ever heard of the concept. But the woman goes off into the forest, and she's free and independent. And she and the male actually stands back. And for the next 9 months, it's the man who sits around and guards the egg. Normally, the female has to carry, you know, her young for 9 months. And she's, you know, getting so grumpy, and she's so demanding, and the husband has to cater to her orders. But it's the opposite with these little fowl, is that the husband is the one who's looking after everything. And so the interesting thing is that this bird, she'll come back every week or so for the next month, and she'll plant an egg every time. And what does the husband do at this point? The temperature around this area, I heard, is something like to hatch an egg has to be 98 degrees. If it gets too hot, the egg will fail. It won't actually fertilize properly. If it gets too cold, similarly, the chick will die. If it varies by 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, it said, so about 1 degree Celsius, if the temperature fluctuates that much, then there's no hatch, there's no birth. So the male, he's responsible for actually maintaining the temperature. And how does he do that? Does he go to the store and buy a thermometer? No, he sticks his beak in the mound, and with his beak, he has a special organ by which he can determine the temperature, a perfect thermometer. So like when we're cooking, for example, you may put your finger in to see how hot your sweet rice is. And so you can judge with your intelligence, but this male also has the same intelligence to detect 1 degree. Even humans, we don't have the same sensitivity. We often need to rely on some external instrument. You know, in the West, at least, you stick a big thermometer in the turkey to see if it's cooked, because we don't have that ability. But this bird does. And so what he'll do for the next 9 months is determine if there's too much sun in the sky, then he needs to put more sand on top to shield the eggs from the extra sun. If it's the leaves are rotting too much, then it's too hot inside, and so he needs to remove sand from the top. And so throughout the day, he'll be constantly adding and removing sand from the top of this pile. But the thing is, the temperature, the weather fluctuates dramatically, and so he actually has another specific ability to detect weather before it comes. He actually can feel the upcoming weather changes in his bones or something. Like they said during the South Indian tsunami, you heard about that in Sri Lanka and Thailand, so many hundreds of humans died. You know, they were out for a peaceful swim. They were enjoying drinking their Mai Tai on the beach, just relaxing in the sun. And the next minute, there's a mile-high tsunami that just killed hundreds and hundreds of humans. But the interesting point is that during the tsunami, how many animals died? How many fowl, how many fish died? The answer is zero. Because the animals have this kind of intelligence built into them that they can detect the tsunami for maybe hours before it's actually going to strike. More intelligent than the human. And so in the same way, this bird, this mallee fowl, can detect changes in the weather, and he'll start preparing his nest in advance in order to prepare. And so this goes on for 9 months. He'll be doing this. And so finally, when it comes time for the chick to hatch, the chick will use its strong lower legs. They're quite developed at this point. It'll scratch its shell, and it'll emerge from its egg. But the problem is it's buried inside a 5-foot mound of sand like that. And so there's no air, and there's no sunlight. It can't see a thing. And so the chick instinctively knows that it has to shut its beak, otherwise it'll inhale a mouthful of sand, and it has to close its eyes tight, otherwise its eyesight will be damaged. So it keeps these closed, and it starts to burrow. It starts to dig its way out of this mound. But because it's so small, it has to stop every 5 minutes or so to rest for a whole hour. And then it'll proceed for another 5 minutes of effort, and then rest for an hour. It can take anywhere from 2 to 15 hours for this little chick to emerge from the mound. By the time it's gotten out, this Australian forest is known for its foxes, who are predators, who like to eat this little bird. So the first thing it does is it takes a deep breath of air, it opens its eyes, and it falls over and starts rolling down the hill. And it rolls down the mound. And as soon as it hits the ground, it runs directly into the brush, into the scrubland, to escape detection. Another factor is that this mallee fowl has such a plumage that it can actually camouflage itself very secretly within the brush like that. And so the thing is, at this point, the chick will run away and it never comes home. The mother and father, just like when Shukadeva Goswami ran away from home without answering his parents' cry, this chick also runs away from home, and the parents never get a chance to instruct it how it itself can reproduce, how it itself can learn the techniques and the technology of nest building. No instructions imparted. Jai Shri Shri Radha Gopinath Bhagwan Ki Jai Lalita Devi Vishakadevi Ki Jai. So this chick is left to its own devices, but soon enough, within its 30-year life, it'll start reproducing itself, it'll find its own mate, and the cycle will continue. Without any teaching, training, or knowledge, it'll repeat the exact same process as its parents performed. And so what modern-day biologists have discovered is that the coincidence, or you could say the sum of factors that are required to generate this kind of intelligence and this kind of system, reproductive system, in the animal, is such that, according to Darwin's theory of natural selection, it is impossible, according to their genetic mutation theory, for this kind of animal to develop this kind of intelligence, for it to develop these kind of sense organs where it can detect temperature, where it can detect weather. From the mother's perspective, she has to come back every week. From the father's perspective, the cock, He has to know when the temperature is fluctuating, when the weather is changing. He has to know the science of how to build the nest, how much sand to remove, how much to remove. This is very sophisticated. And from the chick's point of view, it has to have the proper camouflage to evade getting eaten, and it has to have the proper bodily anatomy enabled to emerge from this mound, and it has to have that instinctive knowledge to repeat the process itself. So what the intelligent design theorists will argue is that this reproductive system is one of irreducible complexity. Irreducible complexity means that so many factors have to be in place. So many kind of technologies have to be enabled for this to work. And if any one single piece of the system is not enabled, is not fully developed, then the whole system fails. Like, for example, if the father's done a good job, he's maintained the temperature nicely, they've produced a nice chick, but if the chick doesn't have the proper leg strength to get out, then it's dead, and it can't get anywhere. If the father does not have the intelligence to wait for the rains to create the rotting leaves, then there's no reproduction. So in order for a Darwinist to explain this, they would have to say that gradually, step by step, each intermediate stage of evolutionary development was superior to the previous one. It was a preferable trait over the previous one, such that by natural selection, it actually got selected as a beneficial adaptation. You would have to draw a line that would track all these mutations one after the other. But the thing is, it is completely inconceivable. To date, they haven't come up with a single plausible theory how all these pieces could be in place at the same time. And so it is the biggest blow, practically, to the Darwinian argument how this animal could have this intelligence. And so this leaves us at a point. Okay, great. So this is a very sophisticated animal, but how does it know how to regulate the temperature, when the weather is going to change, how to reproduce properly? The answer is, the only plausible explanation is that there is a superior intelligence guiding it at every single moment, and this is the supersoul. So the more scientists study this, the more they realize that there is actually some kind of force, some kind of active dynamic intelligence guiding the behavior of this little chick. At every moment, according to Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says in the 15th chapter, Sarvasya chaham ridhi sannivishto matasmritir jnanam apohanam cha, that I am seated within everyone's heart as the supersoul, and I give smriti, remembrance, jnana, knowledge, and apohanam, forgetfulness, all the knowledge that every single living entity can muster at its will is coming through the Lord. The Lord is giving us all the intelligence we need, and we are not responsible for anything except to express our free will. So in the same way, the supersoul is sitting within the heart of this little bird, just like it's sitting in you're in my heart. And interestingly enough, the analogy that's given in Bhagavad Gita is Dvasuparna Sayuja Sakaya. In the Upanishads, it's said that in the tree, there are two birds sitting on a branch. And one bird is looking this way, eating fruits. Sometimes he gets a bitter fruit. Sometimes he gets a sweet fruit. But either way, he's enjoying happiness and distress, pecking away at the fruits. But he's got his head turned to the bird behind him. He doesn't realize that his friend is right behind him on the branch, observing, witnessing all his activities. And so as long as this bird is absorbed in his little world of enjoying and suffering, he's oblivious to the existence of this bird behind him, and he has to enjoy and suffer. But as soon as this bird turns its head towards the existence of the bird behind him, then he develops a new friend, a new relationship. He actually develops an intimate friend in the supersoul like that. So in the same way, it's explained that within our heart, the soul is there, that's us, that's the little tiny 1/10,000th, the tip of a hair in size, jivatma. But what on earth can a little tiny spark do? Like, for example, next to a grain of sand, what is 1/10,000th tip of a hair? the little sand particle is like a mountain next to the soul. How can this little tiny jivatma move a grain of sand on its own? It has no legs, it has no ears, it has no limbs. What can a little tiny spark do? It's like us trying to move a mountain. You decide, oh yeah, tomorrow I'm going to go move Mount Everest. What's the likelihood? So in the same way, according to Bhagavad Gita, how on earth can this little chicken pour all the sand on the mountain? How can I pick up this grain? How can I pick up this glass, I mean? So what's at work here is that the super soul, as explained in this verse, is upadrashtanumantacha bhokta bharta maheshvara, that he is witnessing, he is seeing, and he is sanctioning. Everything has to go through the super soul. The system by which this bird can get this intelligence is that for whatever reason, as a soul, he misbehaved and he developed an animalistic mentality and he took a body of this little chicken-like animal. And so what are the main activities for a little animal? Eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. This is his desires. Because at some point or another, a human being misused his independence. He completely ignored spiritual knowledge and developed an animalistic mentality that the most important thing in my life is, oh, where do I find food? Oh, how do I have children? Oh, what about my career? What about my grandchildren? What about my house? The only mentality that this human being had was within this realm of struggling for existence. As a result of that mentality, what happens? Yam yam bapi smaran bhavam tyajatyante kalevaram tattare vaiti kontaya saratat bhava bhavitaha. In the 8th chapter, it said that depending on the consciousness that one has at the moment of death, it's called svabhava, our attitude, our mentality, our culture, to that extent we'll develop another body in our next life. And if at the moment of death one is simply thinking of, oh, what about my children? Oh, I wish I had spent more time with my family. One develops this bodily attachment, then one gets the opportunity to experience family life again. But this time, perhaps as a dog, as a cat, maybe as an East Australian mallee fowl. This is the danger of misusing our human intelligence. If we don't recognize the super soul in our lives, if we don't see the divine, we don't come to the platform of spiritual knowledge, then the danger is we become a chicken potentially. So therefore, what happens in the mind of this chicken is that, okay, he wants to eat. So the super soul instructs him, hey, over there, there's a little insect, there's a grub. And the chicken looks around and he sees, oh, there's a grub. And he runs over there and he pecks at it. Why is it Prabhupada says that within the animal kingdom, you hardly ever see animals dying of starvation. You hardly see them lined up at the food bank, or, you know, you don't have these telemarathons to, you know, support for only $5 a day. You can sponsor a starving chicken or something. Even though they're out in the wild, they don't have jobs, they don't have credit cards, they don't have any mundane education, yet they're eating every single day, somehow or other. Human beings, we have this attitude that, if I don't get into this very prestigious engineering school, then my life is doomed. If I flunk out and I fail my, what are they called, KTKTs, ATKTs, then there's no prospect of me getting a good career like that. Some parents, they're so obsessed about the future prospects of the earning potential of their children that they enroll the kids right from 4 years old, right from preschool, into the high class, most prestigious preschool you can. The children, the little toddlers, 3-4 years old, actually have to pass like an entrance examination to get into this preschool because there's so much competition and it's so expensive, tuition. And so the little examination, they can't read and write yet, but they have little colors and blocks and they have to draw circles and walk in a straight line just to assess the future intelligence of this child. And if the parents, this is very common in the West for among rich people, if their little toddler doesn't get into the right preschool, oh, they're totally despondent. Now, there goes the future of my child. He'll never get into Harvard or Yale now. So this is the fear in all of our lives, is we're always worried, about our economic situation, gaining and losing. We're always worried about getting good grades, and we're always worried about getting fired, and there's always this fear to just struggle for existence like that. But you see, and so we're always either in the future, hankering after something that's outside of our grasp. If only I keep working harder, then I can buy myself that microwave and that new couch or that new car I've been hankering for. We're always in the future. Or, simultaneously, we can be lamenting for the past. Oh, this person broke my heart. You think they'll accept me back? Oh, if only I had studied a little bit harder in college, then maybe I wouldn't be working. I'd be in the first class train instead of the second, third class. So this lamentation is there. Human being is either in the future or either in the past. This is called spriha or shoka or lamentation. You're always one or the other. And so you're never in the moment. And in the moment is the only time you can actually experience peace. Isn't that right? If you're eating, a meal happily, and it's your favorite dish, your mom just cooked it for you, but then you get a telephone call, and someone says, apparently your dog just died, or, oh no, your grades have come in and you flunked, then how much will you actually experience the meal? Even though the ingredients are the same, the spoon is the same, your mouth is the same, your taste buds are the same, you can't enjoy because your mind is, hankering or lamenting for something. It's lamenting in the past. So you can enjoy as long as you're not in the present. But the difference in the animal kingdom is the animals always fixed in the present. They're always constantly just aware of their surroundings. Because there's an animal that might eat them at any moment, because they have to forage for food, they don't accumulate a bank account, or they don't have, a big granary where they can stock. Well, maybe squirrels do. But most animals are living just day to day, moment to moment, and so they get a full experience, and in that experience, they can take instruction from the supersoul. They actually enable themselves to be very quiet in their minds and just live according to their instincts and just act on a whim. Okay, kick open the shell. Okay, open your eyes now. Okay, run into the forest. And in one sense, they're very much surrendered to the supersoul, that they actually get a good result in life and everything flows into their lives naturally because they're always in the present. So there's always so many difficulties and challenges in the life of an animal. It's very austere. But they get a rich experience. They get to really get the most out of their meager existence and then move on to a superior form of life. They graduate to the next form of life. Like if you're a bird, then you might become a mammal, and then you might become like a cow, and then a human. But the human being, on the other hand, never really gets a rich experience as long as he's in the future or present, and we can never fully listen to the supersoul. Because our mind is going crazy, because we're always hankering and lamenting after something, we never are quiet and still enough to realize the presence of God in our hearts. And as Prabhupada is saying in this verse, he gives instruction within, and he gives instruction without. Within, this is the supersoul. And he's communicating with us. He's trying to tell us that, no, you should be a good person, and okay, you can go ahead and enjoy that material sense gratification, but within the sinful activity is the seed of your own suffering. By engaging in so much material enjoyment, especially against the rules of Scripture, you're actually ensuring future misery in your own life. And so that's why we have a conscience. Every single one of us, at some point, we want to do something bad. Oh, well, what if I just went to see this movie? Nobody will, care. Oh, if I'm all by myself, then I can look at this magazine, or I can watch this TV show, or, oh, I can cheat on this exam, or, oh, I can steal money or steal this. Whenever we want to do something bad, there's always a little voice in the back of our heads that's saying, oh, no, you shouldn't. That's wrong. And in one sense, our parents or our culture has instilled this in us, this sense of morality, of duty. But who can deny that if you really meditate and think deeply, there's this overriding sense of guilt within our hearts when something wrong we're about to do. Something is trying to stop us. There's this little voice within. And when this voice within is supported and backed up by the voice without, then we know that this is good and this is bad. This is the instruction within and without. So Bhagavad Gita is there to guide our lives properly, that you should act in this way, you should serve the Lord in this way. And the Super Soul is also within our hearts, also guiding us, telling us what's bad and what's good. Or as a famous analogy goes, the good dog and the bad dog are always barking at each other. And if you actually feed the good dog, who represents Dharma, who represents proper activity, if you feed him more by giving him good intelligence, you give this dog more food, then he becomes very strong. So the more we read this Bhagavad Gita, the more we associate with devotees, the more developed our intelligence can become. We're sharpening the sword of intelligence. And we can allow the Super Soul, the Paramatma, to act. So we have to be in the moment. We have to stop hankering after things. Yeah, you want, you know, a lack of rupees, and you think that that lack of rupees is really going to satisfy me. But the problem is, that's a goal that exists in the future. It's like a mirage. When you're in the desert, you see a puddle of refreshing, cool, clear drinking water in the future, ahead on the horizon. And your parched throat just demands that you chase after it. Your intelligence is telling you, there's no water in the desert. This is craziness. But because of that hankering, you'll run madly, dashing after this water, dive into the pool, and instead wind up with a dry, hot mouthful of sand. Because the mirage never existed in the first place. And so in the same sense, in this material world, so many unlimited desires are there. We do so much work. So much karma, activity, endeavor for that future satisfaction. But once we obtain that satisfaction, we always want more. You thought a lakh rupees sounded really good. But once you get it, then what do you want? Then you want a crore of rupees. As soon as you get a crore of rupees, then what's the next? You want 10 crore rupees, 100 crore rupees. There's no limit. And how is this? You look at the billionaires. It's like this guy's got one of our famous billionaires in Mumbai. He's building the biggest, most expensive residence in the whole planet right now. I think it's something like a 20-story building. And on every single floor of his residence for his family of four or something, every floor has a different building material. This first mezzanine floor is the marble theme. The second floor is the ivory theme. The third floor is the wood theme. Then the tropical plant theme. And so every single floor has a different kind of ecosystem to live in like that. And so what's he doing? He's just trying to outdo the other richest guy. It's not enough that he has the nicest car. I've met rich people who, okay, first you get your sports car, and then you have to drive on all the little roads. And then you can't just drive on a normal country or city road because you can't get very fast in Mumbai. So then they get the off-wheeler, four-wheel drive, so they can drive anywhere they want. And after getting the four-wheel drive, then they say, hey, why the road? Why not a yacht? And they get their own private sailing vessel so they can go anywhere in the world around. And then what's the next step? That's still two-dimensional. So then they say, oh, the next step to outdo my other competitors, to get a plane. And then that plane's not even enough today. You see the richest, he's with this Russian oil tycoon, this billionaire. He actually paid NASA or the Soviet space program to purchase space tourism. He wants to get in the airship, have a honeymoon with his wife, to go and circumambulate, do parikrama of the moon, like that. So there's no limit. And after they do the moon, then they'll say, oh, what about Mars? Yeah, Mars is a good idea. And then after that, then they're going to try to go outside of the galaxy and then the universe. There's no limit. Because as long as you're the controller and enjoyer, there's never sufficient satisfaction for you. There's no end. As long as you're trying to imitate God like that. So in the same way, when you're always fixed in the future, hankering after something, you can never be in the present. So the point is, in order to listen to the Super Soul, in order to really commune with God in the heart, we need to just relinquish those material desires just for a moment and see, what does God want from me? What is the Super Soul trying to tell me? He's speaking to us at every moment, but the problem is we don't understand his language very well. when you're trying to learn a new language, you know, I'm struggling to learn Hindi, but people will speak things like so fast and you can pick up one or two words and you get an inkling of the message, but it's not enough to sink in. But with the super soul, the way he's trying to speak to us is that you should just try to become more spiritual, try to follow Bhagavad Gita in your life better. All this material enjoyment, it's a waste of time. And he'll convince us, birth after birth after birth after birth, he's constantly giving us messages. Sometimes these messages are very gross. Like I heard this funny story about a man, he was so depressed in his life and he wanted to commit suicide. But you read about failed suicide attempts all the time in the newspaper. That this person maybe like slit his wrists in the bathtub and then his roommate found him and then brought him to the hospital and brought him back to life. And then this person, he's so depressed that his suicide attempt failed. So he'll try to commit suicide again and again it fails. So there was an interesting story about a man. He said, okay, I'm going to commit suicide, but I'm going to do it right the first time. And so he said, well, first I'll hang myself. But wait, that's not enough. Next, I'll get a gun and I'll shoot myself in the head at the same time as the noose drops. But just to be safe, I'll jump off a cliff at the same time and tie the noose to the top of the cliff and I'll carry the gun in my hand. And just in case that doesn't work, what I'll do is I'll drink some poison like that. And then guaranteed, there's no way this can fail. And so the man got his gun, he got his poison, he got his noose, went to the edge of the cliff, and he's like, okay, left his goodbye notes, and he said, goodbye, cruel world. And he jumped off the cliff, he let go of the noose, he tried to shoot himself, and he tried to drink the poison. But the problem is, the gun misfired, it clicked. And because when the noose hit his neck, he actually accidentally shot the top of the noose. And so the noose broke. And so he didn't actually hang himself. He just started falling from the cliff. The poison entered his throat. And he was falling, falling, falling. But the problem is, the cliff he jumped off jumped into water. And when he jumped into the cold water, the shock was so violent that he immediately vomited up all the poison. And some bystanders on the shore saw this man fall into the water and they dove in the water and they rescued him and pulled him out to safety like that. So this man decided that, okay, maybe it wasn't meant to be. Maybe there's a chance that all the forces of nature were conspiring against me. And so he got a very direct message. This was, you could say, an example of the super soul, not just whispering or murmuring. It was actually an example of the super soul shouting, screaming out the message loud and clear so he could get it. So in the same way in our lives, sometimes we're so attached to something. We just want it so bad. But over and over and over again, our attempts are getting dashed. They're getting spoiled. Like I heard one example of Thomas Edison, the inventor of the light bulb or something. He went through like 1,000 different attempts, you know, to create this light bulb, 1,000 failures before he actually came to a successful invention. And so you might say, oh, wow, great. Persistence really pays off. That's wonderful. But the problem is, in the case of human life, persistence to enjoy material happiness and sense gratification, it's not quite the same as Thomas Edison inventing the light bulb. Why? Because we're under the stringent laws of material nature, and the only result you get from this persistence is suffering, followed by suffering, followed by more suffering. There is only one ultimate result in this material world, and that's Mamupetya Punarjanma Dukhalaya Mashashmuktam Natuvanti Mahatmana. That this world is called dukkha laya. Like you may have a bhojan laya or some other kind of, you know, whatever. But the point is, you come to this place in order to suffer. But you may say, oh, but what about the successful results? Oh, I worked hard, I got my degree. Oh, I have nice family, I have a big house now. Oh, maybe you're even so successful, you got elevated to the heavenly planets. So the point is, the only way you attained to this happiness in this birth was by following the instructions of the Vedas, by following the Gita. Only by following proper rules of conduct, by following proper dharma, you get a good result in this world. But the problem is, just like summer gives way to autumn, gives way to monsoon, gives way to spring, gives way to summer. The seasons are constantly changing in a continual pattern. Just like the moon, even though it's full on one day, it'll always be receding. There's one story of Akbar and Birbal. And so King Akbar, he sent his little minister, Birbal, away to a foreign king, to the Persian Empire, as like a goodwill mission to talk to the king. And so Birbal went alone on this diplomatic mission. And at the end of his trip over there in the Persian Empire, the Persian king, before the entire king's assembly, asked Birbal, he said, "So, now that you've seen this Mughal Empire in India, and now that you've seen this Persian Empire, tell me, which is the more prosperous, the more flourishing civilization according to you?" And so Birbal was in a very difficult situation. How do you answer this question? It's almost damned if you do, damned if you do. If he says that the Persian king is so great and magnificent and superior, then Akbar will find out and he may kill him for treason or something or punish him severely. However, if he glorifies Birbal and insults the Persian king to his face, then he may face some severe consequences right there. So how did Birbal overcome this tense moment, this dilemma? He told the king, "In my opinion, the Persian Empire is just like the full moon, resplendent in its shining glory and radiance. Whereas Akbar over there in India, he's just like the little tiny sliver moon, like that." And so the Persian king, oh, he was so great. They started clapping, hari boling. Everyone is so happy with Birbal. They rewarded him handsomely, and he went back to his kingdom in India. But word had spread, and the word reached Akbar's ears that Birbal had actually insulted him in front of the entire Persian kingdom, that his reputation had been tainted by the private confidential minister. And so he immediately arrested him, stuck his guards upon Birbal and told him, "So for this offense, you will have to suffer great torture. Do you have anything to say for yourself beforehand?" And so Birbal said, "Yeah, I do actually. The real esoteric meaning of this statement is that the full moon, how long can it really stay full for? It's full for one day, but the immediate moment that it reaches its peak of fullness, at that next moment, it's immediately shrinking, 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 and it starts to decrease in size until eventually it goes back to what? The new moon, the Amavasya. How long does the Purnima really last for?" So in the same way, my statement meant that the Persian Empire is finished, that it's at the end of its glory. It's on its way down. And you, on the other hand, my dear king, are going to overtake the entire world with your glorious, growing magnificence. And so Birbal said, "Oh, okay, very good." And he dismissed him like that. So in the same way, within our lives, sometimes Purnima, sometimes Amavasya. Just like in the ocean, you see that sometimes the wave picks up these little foam and bubbles to the top, but the next moment it crashes down, picks it up, crashes down. The ocean is never steady. It's always churning. In the same way, our material lives, always constantly churning. You may go up to the spiritual world, to the heavenly planets, but as Krishna says, he says that evam bhuktva svarga lokam vishanti tetam bhuktva vishalam. He says that once you attain and all your pious credits are extinguished, then you come back to this mrityuloka and you start over again. So one can only perform pious activity for a certain point until you become sick of it, until you actually question in your mind, "Well, you know, this life of peacefulness and knowledge is okay, but what about that action over there? What about this happiness? I haven't experienced that in a long time." And so the living entity is never satisfied, and pious activity eventually gets replaced by sinful activity. The sinful activity will go on for so long until you suffer immensely, immeasurably, until you change your ways and then start performing pious activity. So if you think about this bird in terms of accepting God, accepting the path of religion, and then rejecting the path. Sometimes he's turning towards, sometimes away. Sometimes he's moving closer, sometimes he's receding. And this is what Prabhupada is saying, is that we're actually very close friends with the Lord, but we've rejected him. We've misused our free will such that we're stuck in this paradigm of happiness and distress because we're selfish. This is what it boils down to, is because we think, I'm the soul. I'm the one who's going to work hard, attain success. I'm going to be happy. And we forget about the super soul who's there in our heart. If we actually stop for a moment and try to quiet our minds for long enough such that we're submissive to the message of Gita, we're willing to just pipe down for a moment and listen to what Krishna is trying to instruct us in here. We hear every day, listen to this message. You associate with devotees. You discuss this message. You try to practice this message constantly, day in, day out. And what happens over time is that gradually, as Prabhupada's saying, is that one begins to advance toward a blissful, eternal life of knowledge. One actually develops realization of the supersoul. When you try to see the supersoul around you, you try to interpret the ways in which he's communicating with you. He's trying to tell you, this endeavor, yeah, it was a good attempt, but it's not the real happiness in life. So what's coming out in Bhagavad Gita at this point is that Arjuna, he's a family man. He's a grihastha. He's a warrior. And he's trying to enjoy. And on the basis of that enjoyment, he's telling Krishna, I don't want to fight. He says, I want to just go in the forest. Otherwise, I'll get so much sinful reaction. So the same with us in our personal lives. The way the Vedic system is designed is such that family life is entered into, but not as a permanent ashram. That of the four ashrams that are there within the Vedic system, three of them are meant for renunciation, and only one is meant for material opulence and comfort. That's the grihastha ashram. Otherwise, it's brahmachari, vanaprastha, or sannyas, like that. So the reason is that grihastha ashram is a very good learning experience and opportunity to see the super soul working in our lives, to actually determine in our minds and develop that realization that God's trying to tell me something. He's trying to tell me that much as I try to enjoy my money, my wealth, my family relationships, it's nice, but there's something missing. That it's not the kind of blissful, you know, never-ending flow of ecstasy that it's made out to be or that we might consider it to be. It's somewhat like a mirage in the sense that we go in to our relationships in the material world with very high expectations. But eventually over time, inevitably, due to the decaying force of nature, our body gets decayed or the attraction we felt for an individual starts to go, or the children we used to love so much are not really dependent on us. They become so independent. And the same satisfaction we got from our relationships in the beginning, they start to gradually recede. And one can realize, after a very full, successful, productive life in the grihastha ashram, we say that, I'm glad I went through that. Now it's time to dedicate myself towards realizing the super soul, towards meditating on God in the heart, and on trying to actually retire from my material activities and adopt activities that are directly connected to God, like that. So it has to be done properly, according to the rules of scripture. And this is why Krishna is saying, we have to take this external inspiration from Bhagavad Gita, from the scriptures. Because as long as one thinks that the happiness from my life is coming from the sense objects, what this 13th chapter is developing is the eyes of jnana, shastra chakshu, is to see the field of activities. And how does this apply to our lives? It applies because when you're embracing your beautiful child, we have to remember that the happiness that's coming from is not from dead matter. Because as Krishna is saying in the beginning of this chapter, there's bhutani, how does he say it? He says that all these elements that make up the field of activities, are just a bunch of earth, fire. Mahabhutani ahankaro buddhiravyaktam evacha indriyani dashaikamcha pancha chendriya gochara pancha chendriya indriya. So at the beginning of the chapter, Krishna said that there's bhumir, apo, nalo, vayu. So everything that we consider to be happiness, like a relationship, is just a bunch of dirt. It's just a bunch of, you know, fire and a bunch of water and a bunch of air that's constituted together. But the soul is really what's important about this individual. But not only that, but what is actually generating the happiness in this individual is the super soul. Because as the super soul enters creation, he's the principle of happiness. So what this means is that Krishna is called Akila Rasamrita Murti. He's the actual ocean or the embodiment of all happiness. And any pleasure we get from drinking water, eating a good meal, watching a good TV show, embracing your loved one, it's just a bunch of flesh with a little tiny soul. But the real happiness is coming because the way this material gross body is interacting with our material gross body, the happiness is generated by Krishna. As Krishna says, Rasoham apsukonteya prabhasmi shashi suryayo, that the taste that's coming from water, what is it? It's just an interaction of a bunch of molecules touching some other dead matter. Water's not conscious, our tongue's not conscious. But where is the happiness coming from? Krishna says, Rasa aham. He says, I am taste. Or in the Upanishads, Krishna says, Raso vaisaha. He says that, what is rasa? It's he. It's the super soul. It's God. So this is the purpose of the 13th chapter, is do your activities. You engage in your life, in your career, in your occupation, in your duties, but see it with the eyes of knowledge. That the happiness that's generated from my position is actually Krishna. It's actually Krishna as he's expanded himself into the material world. It's the super soul that is generating the happiness, but the matter in and of itself cannot make me happy, cannot penetrate to the soul. And so rather than take the temporary happiness of these material objects around us, you start to connect these objects to Krishna, and eventually you see, why should I go for the little meager, tiny little happiness that I can extract from this material world? Like in the desert, you can't get the mirage, but what if somebody offers you a little bit of a drop of water on your tongue? You're dying of thirst, and someone offers you a little drop. That's more annoying than anything, isn't it? You want like a big pitcher of water to quench your thirst. You're so dehydrated, but somebody just gives you a little drop. And so that's what our material pleasure is really like. So the reason this analogy is used is because the water in the desert may not exist there, but water does exist. There is such a thing as water. You're just not going to find it in the desert. So what this means is that the pleasure we seek is real. The living entity is Sat-Chit-Ananda. God is also Sat-Chit-Ananda. But the problem is, we don't get any ananda from dead matter. You know, you rub like this clip against this, and where's the interaction of happiness? Where's the happiness being generated? You put this tongue against, you know, good, like a rasgulla, but where's the happiness? It's just matter. The real happiness principle is the living entity interacting with Krishna, the soul interacting with the super soul. So this is the key to finding happiness and peace in our lives. And this is what the 13th chapter is trying to bring out, is this consciousness, this awareness. Nobody's saying, give up your family life, give up your job, just become a renunciate, sit under a tree, go sit in a cave, go meditate on the super soul. No one's saying that. Krishna's definitely not saying that. He says, if you can do that, fine, no problem. But for the majority of us, the purpose or the gradual elevation towards this elevated spiritual consciousness is to do your activities, to go about your life, do it in relationship with God's instructions, and try to see God everywhere. Try to see God in the heart of your child, God in the heart of your husband, God in the heart of your wife, got in the heart of the dog on the street. And so in this way, we become so purified, and as will come out in the next verse, that it actually leads to liberation. If we can actually recognize the super soul in the heart, he will not take birth here again, regardless of his present position. Krishna is saying, he's guaranteeing liberation. One who understands this philosophy concerning the super soul, the living entity, and the reaction of the modes of nature, sure to attain liberation. This is the power of knowledge. This is what's coming out in the 13th chapter of Gita, is acting with proper knowledge. So, whereas we're not quite as lucky as the little Mallee fowl in East Australia that God's instructing us at every moment, he's not screaming loudly, but we have the Gita, we have devotees, we have spiritual master, we have Srila Prabhupada, and he's given us everything we need in order to take constant association of the super soul. And so this is the very goal of our lives, is to strive, when you go out there on the street, to not say, oh, temple is very nice, it's very spiritual, the people are nice, and the food is all spiritual, it's prasadam, but out there, that's maya, inside is spiritual. This is a false dichotomy. We have to go outside and see the super soul out there. See the super soul between every atom in our lives, in our children, in our wife, in our boss at work, in the people on the train that you want to beat up because they're stepping on your foot. Still, you have to have this vision of the super soul. And so, I thank you very much for listening so patiently. Are there any questions before we move on to the kirtan part of the program tonight? Jai Shriman Bhagavad Gita ki jai. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Samaveta Bhaktavrinda ki jai. Hare Krishna.